This week on Making Contact.
After a while, you know, if you tell me enough times that I'm not human, I begin to believe it. And that's why we don't rise up.
250 years of slavery, 100 more years of legalized segregation and oppression. Millions of African American families were torn apart, and their religious and cultural norms were completely silenced.
Everything from what we eat to what we believe it means to be a man or a woman, all of those things have been tainted by some of the most horrific history of anybody.
On this edition, we bring you Dr. Joy DeGruy, speaking about her book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. I'm Esther Minia, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder that occurs as a result of a single trauma. What we have to consider is looking at that one singular event. Now let's roll it back and say, we're not talking about one event, we're talking about a lifetime of trauma. So it's not plausible, and while we can't measure the post-traumatic, quote, stress disorder, it's not plausible that black people escaped without that diagnosis. Now, what are the symptoms? Think about this. Exaggerated startle response, outbursts of anger, feeling of foreshortened future. Now, start thinking about what has been folded in as cultural behavior. What you looking at? You start thinking about what is now adaptive social learning that has been transmitted, because I may not have been broken, but if my mama was broken, I didn't know her behavior was broken behavior. And there was nobody to come in and help treat us during slavery or after. So let's look at it in terms of math. 246 years of trauma. And for those who really need to believe they're happy slaves, take them out of the equation. But those who weren't so happy, that were injured by seeing people beaten and raped and sold, let's say now they didn't get treated, but they got freed. So 246 years of trauma, no intervention, no help, then you got freed. And then the trauma continued, didn't it? Jim Crow was after slavery. The whole Klan was after slavery. So now let's do the math. 246 years of trauma, no help, freed, no help, more trauma. We're amazing. We're amazing.
That's the voice of renowned author and educator, Dr. Joy DeGruy. She tours the world conducting workshops and seminars on culture and race relations for everyone, from the FBI to Nike. In April 2011, Dr. DeGruy spoke in San Francisco as part of the California Institute of Integral Studies Conversations That Matter series, Healing the Wounds of Intergenerational Trauma. The theme of DeGruy's talk was post-traumatic slave syndrome, a controversial theory that reaches into every facet of American society.
Let me speak very directly to this whole notion of what it is and what it isn't and how I arrived at it. As a social scientist, one of the first things that I noticed was just the behavior towards the title, post-traumatic slave syndrome. There's just a visceral response in America when you say the slave is attached to anything. Oh, come on now. Really? I mean, slavery? I mean, who are you trying to blame now? What excuses are you people? I wasn't there, okay? I didn't own any slaves, and aren't you free now? Right? So this is just saying the word. You know, I haven't really, you know, elaborated, just the word. And I was curious about why there was such a visceral response to the notion of slavery. And when I think about it, you know, those of you that are more familiar know that what I'm looking at is multi-generational trauma. Multi-generational trauma is not a new phenomenon. We've looked at other groups. We've looked at Aboriginal folks in Australia. We've looked at Indigenous natives. You know, we've looked at victims of Holocaust. Why don't we get the pushback there? This is symptomology. This is speaking to a bigger problem. It's the pathology associated with race in America. And that pathology is what kind of first sprang me forward, because anyone that's telling me so forcefully not to look at me was the first indicator that I had to get up close and personal with it. So let me just kind of give you some examples of it that you might kind of understand. When I started to look at historical issues, and again, looking at history also isn't unusual. If you go to the doctor today, and I don't care what you go for, they're going to ask you about your history, they're going to ask you about your mama's history. Similarly, in mental health, as you all know, you want to take that history. You got to take that personal history because, of course, that informs what we're going to do in terms of healing. So that's not new either. But I wanted to understand certain behaviors that I saw exhibited among people that look like me. And I'm going to give you two examples in contemporary society that you see that I kind of trace back to slavery. Now, the way I did that was two ways. One is I read thousands of slave narratives, and two, I interviewed elders. But I had already read many things about these issues. So let me give you one of them. 2011, there's a black mother and a white mother. Each have sons. The sons go to school together, they play together, they spend the night over each other's house, best friends. They find themselves at a meeting like this one. And each mother is seated next to the other, and on either side are the sons. And so the black mother leans over to the white mother, and she says to her, "You know, I just wanted to tell you, I noticed your son is doing really well." And the white mother responds, "Well, thank you for noticing. He really is quite the man. Did I mention he's in tag? He also won the science fair last week. You know, his uncle's an astronaut. The boy's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant." And I'm not mad at her, because she's just really, you know, exuding the pride she has for her son. And so then the white mother stops momentarily and thinks, "Well, you know, actually, the black mother's son was excelling her son." So she thinks, she turns to her, she goes, "Well, what are you saying? You know, what am I saying? You know, my son, well, your son, he's the one that's really coming along." And the black mother's response is, "Yeah, you think so. Ooh, that girl, that boy, he's a mess. You should have seen him yesterday. He's a handful." Have you seen that behavior, right? Now, here's what everybody black in this audience knows, is that even though the parent is saying that, she's really proud, isn't she? Okay, so now let's do the math on that, because I'm not co-signing that behavior, because there's nothing healthy about it. It's not healthy. But the issue is that, you know, we don't understand why we're doing it. So I started to look at that one behavior, and I found its roots as I did read the slave narratives and interviewed folks. So let's roll the scene back a couple hundred years. Black mother, maybe she's in the fields, maybe she's in the kitchen, and she has her children with her. And a white slave owner comes over, might be a male or female, doesn't matter, and sees this mother and sees her children. And she comments to the mother, or he comments to this mother, "Wow, that boy there, that boy yours, he sure is coming along." What would be her response? "Oh, well, no, sir. He's shiftless. He can't work because I don't want you to sell him. And if it's my daughter, I don't want you to breed her." So I denigrate them to protect them. That is called appropriate adaptation when living in a hostile environment. We never unlearned it. And what white people say is, "Well, you know, that's just the way they are. That's just how they are. It's just their culture." But you see, we can ill afford, as people from the African diaspora, we can ill afford to swallow whole what we call cultural, because there is poison in the cookies. And we have to tease that out, because we didn't unlearn it. Because there's a statement that says, as we arrive at our self-construct, it says that I am not who I think I am, and I am not who you think I am. I am who I think that you think that I am. It is how we arrive at our self-concept is based on the appraisal of significant people in our environment. No news there. So it becomes very important to find out what those people believe about who they are, and hence who you are. This is taken from James Gilligan, who is a psychiatrist who worked 25 years in prisons. And essentially what James Gilligan asserted in his book on violence is that it is the destruction of the culture that destroys the person. That it is as intrinsic as food is to the body, as nourishment for the person, or the human, or the psyche. That is what he said. After working with hardened murderers and rapists, he said, "What we have done in this country is we have deprived them of their sense of who they are." Randall Robinson, who wrote the foreword to my book, said, "The worst thing you can do to a people is to rob them of the memory of themselves." I have done work with Dr. Edwin Nichols, whose work is on the philosophical aspects of cultural difference. And Dr. Nichols asserted that the African, and this becomes important as it relates to my work, African and Latino axiology, or primary value system, is member to member. Highest value lies in the relationship between people. The highest value. And then you have to ask, what did American chattel slavery do to that relationship? And so what becomes important as we look at slavery, again, the second retort in terms of the pushback is, well, you know, Joy, slavery is not a new institution. Lots of people have had slaves. You know, the Romans had slaves, you know. So what's the big deal? Well, American chattel slavery was very, very different from most forms that preceded it. It differed in the way in which a person became enslaved, the length of servitude, the treatment of slaves, and most importantly, the way owners viewed them. It was based on the notion of Aristotle, the natural slave. And it was believed that black people were somehow less human. So now we're talking about dehumanization and suggesting that never will you rise to the level of those who've enslaved you. Whereas in other societies, people became absorbed within that society, eventually married and found freedom. That was never to occur with people of African descent. I often talk about the foundation of our problems around race is based on cognitive dissonance. So the first thing that we have to understand was when I started looking at European enslavement of people of African descent, my first question is, how could a people who deemed themselves superior, moral, dignified, intelligent, civilized, engage in behaviors that are the antithesis of that? So then how could a people oppress and subjugate another group of people using the incorrect history that we have for 246 years, with 1619, the date that we were given in the ratification of the 13th Amendment. We're talking about 246 years. How do you reconcile oppressing people for that long? Well, here's the recipe. If ever you are to remove the dissonance, which you must do in order to function, the first thing you must do, number one, is justify your behavior. Number two is becoming the most important thing that we're seeing happen, and that is that you then have to relabel the people to justify your behavior, to fit the behavior towards them. So the very first fundamental contradiction was the Constitution, right? The whole notion of democracy and freedom, and at the same time having people enslaved in the absolute genocide of Native people. How do you reconcile that? Well, that's what we first see. And what the greatest fear is the uncovering of that. So again, blacks had to be defined in a way that made sense. Be clear that in order for these years of subjugation, centuries of subjugation to occur, you had to have institutions that were complicit. How many of you knew that the U.S. apologized for slavery twice? Yeah, they did. They apologized twice. The U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives in 2008 and 2009. And I kept thinking at first, well, did they just remember? No. What happened was, in 2007, Great Britain, where I was touring and doing talks, were acknowledging and commemorating the 200th anniversary of the end of slave trade in England, in Britain. What was the 200th anniversary of the end of the slave trade in America? That would be 2008. We had to do something. And so they apologized, but let's see what they apologized for. With this resolution, the federal government acknowledged the injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery and Jim Crow. The resolution states that the vestiges of Jim Crow continue to this day. African Americans continue to suffer from the consequences of slavery and Jim Crow long after both systems were formally abolished, through enormous damage and loss, both tangible and intangible, including the loss of human dignity and liberty, the frustration of careers and professional lives, and the long-term loss of income and opportunity. They knew. Science as an institution, how did it, become a part of this? Carl von Linnaeus, preeminent scientist, was best known for the classification of species, phylum, genus. You know him from biology. Everyone had to deal with him. He is believed to be the father of anthropology. Linnaeus also was the person who basically began looking at race classification. Even though Egyptians had already done race classification, people will look at his Systema Natura of 1735 as the first modern study of man. And with that study, he also advanced particular peculiarities about the character and temperament. He described Homo Americanus. Who might that be? He said, those are natives. He says, they're reddish, choleric, obstinate, contented, and regulated by customs. Homo Europaeus, that would be white people, he says they're white, fickle, sanguine, blue-eyed, gentle, and governed by laws. Homo Asiaticus, as sallow, grave, dignified, avaricious, and ruled by opinion. And Homo Afer, as black, phlegmatic, cunning, lazy, lustful, careless, and governed by caprice. These insights into what Linnaeus defined as racial character, personality traits, and a host of other related categories were subsequently attempted to be transmitted into a system, a classification of race that became more fixed than the races themselves. Not a shred of science here. Again, what's important here is you go back and you look at what Linnaeus said. By relabeling the people to fit your behavior towards them, don't they deserve it? I just told you that scientifically, Homo afro black people are phlegmatic, cunning, lazy, lustful, and careless. Do you hear me? Don't they deserve it? And now I have effectively removed the dissonance. You know, you had eugenics, breeding human beings, and you have Boaz, who basically said that all of that is foolishness, and that culture, what distinguishes human beings one from another, is culture, and this is not some hierarchical system that eventually leads to a European notion of that. It is intrinsically human as it relates to culture. We now know that race is a concept of society that insists there is genetic significance behind human variances in skin color that transcend outward appearance. However, race has no scientific merit outside of sociological classifications. There are no significant genetic variations within the human species to justify the division of races. Mankind is one. Mankind is one.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. We now return to more of Dr. Joy DeGruy, speaking about her book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing.
So then we have the role of politics. One of the first fears to arise was a fear of annihilation. You're going to get those Indians and them black folks going to get together and they're going to just get us. Now, the irony here is, according to a mid-1800s census, there were over 600,000 mixed-race babies born. Those are the ones they counted. Now, this was during miscegenation. Y'all know what that means? It means it's illegal to be with someone of another race. So there was a whole lot of folks sneaking out back, you think? I actually close out my book with a soliloquy for Thomas Jefferson, and I quote, he says, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I consider that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." He knew. He was plagued with dissonance from the beginning to the end, and still he didn't free his slaves. But let's see what he did say. He said blacks smell bad and were physically unattractive. This is a little inconsistent with his behavior, you think? But let's see what else he says. He says that, interestingly, we require less sleep. See, that was interesting as a social scientist for me. Because, you see, he becomes an important figure in smoothing over the dissonance because he wouldn't lie to us. Well, after all, he's Thomas Jefferson. And if he said it, it must be true. So we have a double problem here. One is the station at which he is, which then convinces not just him and others in the United States, but everyone in the world. Are you following me? So I'm easing the psychological conscience of the world about the legitimacy of the dehumanization of this group of people. So when he says we require less sleep, why would he need to believe that? What dissonance was he experiencing? What was a work day for an enslaved African? Most people don't associate slavery with New York or the North. The truth is all 13 colonies had slavery, with estimates of 10 to 20,000 people buried in the 7-acre burial ground. It's considered the largest known site of its kind in the U.S. Blakey's analysis of human skeletal remains revealed that these men and women were literally worked to death. They suffered from enthesopathies, a condition resulting in the muscle detaching itself from the bone as a result of people being worked beyond human capacity. You lazy people, you. He then said that we were dumb, cowardly, and incapable of feeling grief. These are his words. What dissonance was he experiencing that he needed to believe we couldn't feel grief? He was selling people away, yes, mothers from their children and husbands from wives and brothers from sisters. Surely they don't feel grief. So I just assert that they don't feel grief. And if he said it, everyone believed it. Again, every single institution was engaged in this. Now, this is a book that I really highly recommend every black man, woman, and child have and put on the dash. It's called Breaking Rank, written by Norm Stamper, a 34-year police veteran white man, went back, got his PhD, and he told on everybody. I mean, he told, had people indicted, all kinds of stuff. He says, I've heard some police officers refer to prostitute slayings or to the slayings of blacks as misdemeanor murders, employing an unofficial code for them, NHI, no human involved. It'll be 2005. Norm Stamper ends by saying race and class discrimination are all too real in every phase of the criminal justice system, from arrest to sentencing. Impoverished black defendants are far more likely to wind up on death row than rich or middle class whites. Of the 3,700 inmates now awaiting execution nationwide, 43% are African American. Black defendants are not accorded the same due process rights as whites. Their cases are not given the same scrutiny and consideration afforded white defendants. Look at what he says: not now, not ever, not in this country. Emmett Till's mother knows all so well. But then let's see what we do understand about contemporary Jim Crow. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer, according to Michelle Alexander, black attorney, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to what? Label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you are labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, denial of the right to vote, denial of educational opportunity, denial of food stamps, public benefits, and exclusion from jury service are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights, arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. It must be that we're just more criminal, because you see, even black people believe that. Because after a while, you know, if you tell me enough times that I'm not human, I begin to believe it. And that's why we don't rise up. Because somewhere in there, we've become convinced. And then Arizona is making it law. So we go to Katrina, really personal for me. My family's from Louisiana. My brother was missing for 3 days. And I work with Katrina survivors. And as you see, what I was looking for as a social scientist, because I was looking for empathy. But what I got was anger. Who's responsible? Was it that mayor? Smoke him out. And then we got the intellectuals. Well, I don't know, Martin. Do you think it was class or was it race? Let's ask Condoleezza. People are dying and we've intellectualized it. And where the hell was Dr. Phil? And where are the doctors in the borders? Where were they? Where were the people to talk to the little children that can't get in bathtubs right now because they still can't imagine getting in the water? Where were they to help? I wondered where, but where's, then I got folks, white, black, everybody started rolling up their sleeves, say, you got a truck, you got some goods, you got a boat, we're out. And they said, oh, no, you can't come here, it's too dangerous. Turned them around. Even the people from every background that wanted to help, turned them around, said, it's too dangerous, stay with me, because you need to understand what this is. I was looking for empathy. I was looking for you to feel your way there, not intellectualize it, not hunt for the person who's wrong, not exhibit the anger. But here's where the crocodile tears came. And I might be emotional. Let's see what the press said. All right, let's see. A young man walks through chest-deep water after looting a grocery store in New Orleans on Tuesday, August 30, 2005. That's Associated Press. That's the black person up top. The bottom is the same thing. Folk doing the same thing, only they're white. Here's what it reads. Two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store. The exact same thing is going on, but they need you to know, even in a catastrophe, you're looking at people that says that even in the midst of a catastrophe, they need for you to know who he is. They want you to know, well, that person is looting, because that's what black people do. White people don't loot. Hell, they stole us. But again, they shut it out. They told you they're nothing but rapists and looters. They blocked out the media, and you went to sleep. And more people died. Because you see, they kind of deserved it. They did the same thing with Haiti, right? I was looking for empathy. Stay with me, because you got to understand, in order to create the kind of systems that oppress people, you have to legitimize it, and you rob yourself of your humanity. And that's that just subtle contempt the fear, all of those things.
That's the voice of Dr. Joy DeGruy, speaking about post-traumatic slave syndrome. We conclude today's show with an excerpt of her dialogue with Belvy Rooks, author and co-founder of Growing a Global Heart.
Several years ago, I was on a bus in San Francisco, and when I got on, there was a young African-American, it was very crowded, there was a young African-American teenager sitting in the seats where it says, you know, mm-hmm. you should be disabled or senior. And there were seniors standing by. And there was a tense kind of racial moment because the people standing were white. And you could just feel the energy. Somebody, you know, sure. wanted him to get up. And it took me a while, but you can feel the tension was such that I turned around and I looked and there was this child sitting there. And so I had to make a decision because I was looking at people looking contemptuously at him. And it's like, what do I say? What do I do?
Right.
When I could stand it no longer, I actually went over and said, you know, sweetheart, excuse me, there's some elders and seniors who want to sit down. And he said, oh, okay, thank you. You know, he just, he got right up. But I realized the what I went through, whereas my grandmother would not have waited that long. I had to go over, you know, I mean.
Exactly.
You know, so this whole thing of community and when you talked about reading slave narratives and interviewing elders, there is this intergenerational disconnect.
Yes. That's the other piece of the work is that, you know, is connecting people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've part of the system and part of it is structural. I mean, it's deliberate, you know, in some ways. For example, you know, I grew up and there would inevitably be teen parents, you know, no matter where you go. But they didn't raise the children. You know what I'm saying? You had Big Mama and Poppy and everybody who was there raising the child. Mm-hmm. But now laws are such that, you know, this child has to be in her own space and nobody else can live there. And, you know, and there are all these things that are divisive. And so now you literally have a 15-year-old raising somebody,
right?
And if she happened to be the child of a 15-year-old and grandma's 30 and getting her party on, there's no parenting that has happened, right?
Right.
And then we're wondering why Johnny can't read. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
We aren't looking at the whole picture. We want just a snapshot. And you have teachers that go, well, I'm not a social worker. And, you know, all the, you know, what you've heard mm-hmm. about what it's going to take. But we've never considered the injury. We never considered the impact of what this has had on us as a people and what we've come to believe and everything from what we eat mm-hmm. to what we believe it means to be a man or a woman. All of those things have been tainted.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Dr. Joy DeGruy speaking about her book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. She spoke at the California Institute of Integral Studies Conversations That Matter series in San Francisco on April 21st, 2011. To hear her full speech, along with the question and answer session, go to our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to Dr. Joy DeGruy and the California Institute of Integral Studies. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Con Pham, associate director, Andrew Stelzer and Kyung Jin Lee, producers, Carl Jung Mundensink, volunteer coordinator, Lisa Bart Fai, production intern, Irene Flores, web intern, and Dan Turner, Ron Recker, Alton Bird, Judy Huang, and Alex Collins, volunteers. I'm Esther Mania. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.